Hello and welcome to The Telegram, raised voices from The Telegraph. My name is Tim Stanley. This week we are talking about the toffs who hated Margaret Thatcher almost as much as the miners did. Also, quiet panic in the Labour Party. Is Tony Blair right to imply that Ed Miliband's leadership is an absolute shambles? Joining us in the studio this week are Charles Moore, Damien Thompson, Peter Oborne and Dan Hodges. Margaret Thatcher inspired an extraordinary coalition of hate, from the Bolshie and his student digs to the Tory wet in his castle. Since she passed away on Monday, we've heard a lot from the left, including a celebration party in Brixton that, somewhat predictably, ended in looting. But what we're going to talk about today are the other parts of Mrs. Thatcher's opposition that were drawn from her own party. I'm joined by Charles Moore, whose biography of Lady Thatcher will be launched shortly after her funeral, and Damien Thompson, the editor of Telegraph Blogs. Charles Moore, who were the Tories who opposed Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, and why did they do it?
Well, they were really the Heathites, disappointed and surprised by Heath's failures and the fact that Mrs. Thatcher threw him out. Many of them, though by no means all, were upper class, and they tended to be a particular type of upper class, which is really more of a Whig inheritance than a Tory inheritance. Actually, the upper class Tories were split. The more Tory ones liked Mrs. Thatcher because they said she's a brave girl. All these chaps who'd been in the war and things and backbenchers and were annoyed with Heath, sort of country gentlemen, knights of the shires, they tended to like her and they thought she's brave and decisive. But the rather smaller sort of Whiggish group who'd expected to run the country saw her as a usurper, people like Ian Gilmore, Christopher Soames, Francis Pym, and actually in the younger generation, Chris Patten. And they were very surprised, I think, constantly underrated her. That was one of the troubles. And they saw it as a sort of effrontery that she should be there at all.
Why an effrontery? Was it anything to do with her class or her gender?
I think it was related both to her class and her sex. I mean, to be fair to her critics, they had strong policy disagreements with
yes.
her. But I do think there were certain visceral reactions. And I think one of the visceral reactions was that a woman shouldn't be doing this. And another was that she's crude and vulgar, as they would see it.
A woman shouldn't be doing what? Shouldn't be running the country or shouldn't be so consistently and nakedly right-wing?
Both.
Right.
And I think in their minds, they tended to use the anti-right-wing argument without quite realising it as a sort of cover for other prejudices and feelings, which is to do with really what a woman should be doing. And I've talked to a lot of people who worked with Mrs. Thatcher at that time, including the people I've just mentioned. And I think you could usually divide them to some extent as to whether they did like having an argument with a woman or not.
Right.
And so some of that generation actually thought it was incredible fun dealing with Margaret Thatcher. And Peter Carrington, who didn't agree with her at all on most things, got on pretty well with her. And he actually made her laugh. And he could be hit back. But others, Francis Pym, for instance, found incredibly difficult to just sort of go red in the face and get upset. He couldn't sort of handle the fact that here's this commanding woman. And a lot of people, as it were sort of frightened of their, or disliked the idea of sort of the matron from school or the dreadful nanny. That would be the sort of thought in their mind.
Some people obviously really like that, though. I know that Alan Clark almost found it a sexual thrill to deal with Margaret Thatcher.
Yes. It's difficult for us to understand this because we're much, much younger than her. So, of course, we don't think of her in those terms. But it's undoubtedly true that Mrs. Thatcher had a strong feminine and you could even say sexual presence. I mean, sexual is a slightly odd word to use because she was always completely proper. But there's no question that she's very flirtatious, sort of almost unconsciously flirtatious. And if you look at, I think you can see it more clearly by looking back at film now. So you see her when she's younger, if you see what I mean, and that she's, in many people's eyes, a very handsome and attractive woman, and very much a woman. It's complete rubbish when people say that, she's really a man wearing a skirt sort of thing. Everything was to do with being a woman. So a lot of reaction to that was, do you like that sort of woman or not? I mean, it's very sort of almost animal thing.
Did you experience any of that reaction personally? I mean, during the 80s when you went to dinner parties and you met with conservatives, was it ever socially awkward to be someone sympathetic to Margaret Thatcher?
Oh, yes. I mean, with some of these sort of with these sort of Whiggish patricians, who'd say, "What a ghastly, vulgar, Grose's daughter! She's so crude. How can you bear it?" etc. And then also with the more intellectual BBC types, Oxford types, you know, dons, that sort of thing, and people who were part of the arts mafia as well.
Okay,
and
okay.
A real problem. I think what struck me most of all at that time was the incapacity of such people to understand who she was and what was happening. So it was an extraordinary feeling of them being sort of really behind the times about, I mean, they thought of themselves as sort of radical people often, but they actually were completely not appreciating how the world was changing.
Okay, thank you. I want to bring Damien Thompson at that point to talk about the Loveys and the intellectual types. I remember when I was at Cambridge University, there was a history lecturer who famously began his lecture series by saying, "We all know Margaret Thatcher was evil, but please don't put it down on the exam paper," which I think speaks to the extraordinary casuality of the anti-Thatcher feeling among the upper middle class, sort of
yes.
soft left. Do you agree with that?
There was a sort of haute bourgeois hatred of Margaret Thatcher. You might call it a coalition of North Oxford, the Dons that you've mentioned, and I was at university at the time and I experienced it, and North London, the Loveys, Jonathan Miller, Mary Warnock, Alan Bennett. So many of these people said unbelievably crude and spiteful things. I went to dinner parties in the 80s, vaguely left-wing dinner parties, at which people would sit around sort of cackling at Margaret Thatcher's latest hairstyle over the polenta. These were people who felt intellectually superior to all Tories, but especially to someone like Margaret Thatcher, who spoke as they saw it in shopkeeper's language. And I think an important part of it is that these people had institutional weight behind their sneering. So, for example, many of these people worked for the BBC or worked for publicly funded bodies, and as a result, they were sort of able to carry over their dinner party loathing of Thatcher into publicly funded entertainment and intellectual activity.
And a good example of that would be Oxford University, am I correct? They declined to provide her with a degree.
Yes, I mean, it's a custom that a lot of distinguished people get honorary degrees from Oxford and Cambridge, you know, particularly if they attended those universities, and indeed other universities. And Mrs. Thatcher was in the running for one, put up for it by some dons. But there was a vote on it, and her cause lost. I mean, of course, she wasn't campaigning for it. She wasn't involved in the thing at all. But nevertheless, she was quite strongly defeated for the honorary degree. And when you think about that, I think the people voting against her thought they were being quite brave to defy the Prime Minister, and they were critical of her university policy. But actually, if you stand back and think about it, the first woman Prime Minister of Britain is a graduate of Oxford University, and they don't give her an Oxford degree. I mean, an honorary degree. It's astonishing, actually, the sort of the parochialism and the pettiness of this. But they found it very hard to see it that way, and that's what I mean by the sort of lack of perspective.
I'm curious to ask, it must have rankled with her enormously. Did she feel resentment about that in later years? Did she feel detached from her old university?
It wasn't so much resentment. It was, I think, real sadness, actually. I think it yes. really hurt. She always exempted. She remained very loyal to her own college, Somerville, but it did upset her deeply about Oxford, and it had the consequential result that when she decided to leave her papers to the nation, she gave them to Cambridge.
But one thing that I've always thought was very attractive about her personality was the sense that she didn't care. I mean, Damien, do you think that this kind of criticism, particularly from the academic and Lovey world, do you think it really mattered to her?
I think it mattered to them enormously that she wasn't listening to them, or at least if she was listening to them, she wasn't particularly won over by their arguments or interested in their arguments. The problem for her was this conquest of the large institutions of British society by anti-Thatcher civil servants and broadcasters and academics, who saw themselves losing the political battle at three successive general elections, and therefore sort of poured their disappointment and rage into those channels that were open to them. And I think that to an extent, the anti-Tory hatred that was distilled during those years has never quite dissipated.
Yes, I think that's right. The BBC has fundamentally remained anti-Thatcher. and more anti-Thatcher than anti anyone else, really. You can even now in the sort of, they're trying to be balanced, but you can hear them sort of straining at the leash in talking of her death. I'd just like to make the point that, contrary to what is often said, Mrs. Thatcher did in fact have a great respect for intellectuals, so that it wasn't that she thought, and for great artists and writers and for scientists, so it wasn't that she sort of dismissed all those people. It wasn't that she wished a whole lot to vanish so that she could just get on with the business of making money. Quite the contrary. She was fascinated by pure science, particularly pure science, more than applied science, and by certain types of literature and by sort of big ideas. She wasn't, strictly speaking, an intellectual, but she was excited by all that. And she greatly admired, for example, V.S. Naipaul, Kingsley Amis, Robert Conquest.
All somewhat conservative writers.
Anthony Pohl. Yes, I mean, usually there was... Though often they were liberal writers, but very anti-communist. Mm-hmm. There were people who were basically on the left, but hated communist totalitarianism. And she actually was a very unusual in the prime minister in getting such people in and asking them about things, because she always wanted sort of, you know, what Churchill called irregulars, people who'd come in with batty ideas and fascinating ideas, and 90% wouldn't work, but 10 would. Actually, in certain respects, you could say she was the more interested in this than any other modern prime minister. But what she did not like was the sort of lumpen intelligentsia.
Right.
And she particularly didn't like the idea that, you know, whatever anything these people want to do should be paid for by the government. And, of course, that's one of the big reasons we haven't mentioned why they were so angry with money, because they're always trying to get money for the Arts Council.
Right.
And for whatever a university was getting up to.
And ultimately... To conclude, the whole debate is rather academic, is it not? Because they really hated her because she won. She beat them. And is that not what still really hurts at the heart of the left, the fact that they lost the big battle in the 80s between socialism and capitalism? That's what makes Thatcher so despicable to them.
Yes, though to be fair to the left, some of the left, they had a sort of admiration for her for that. I mean, I remember often hearing at Labour conferences the left saying, why can't we... stand up for our class like she does for hers, that sort of, there was a sort of compliment paid. It was a sort of, I think in both sides, it was sort of the enemy in plain view, and such enemies have us almost a regard for one another.
Charles Moore, Damien Thompson, thank you very much.
Former prime ministers have a habit of haunting us. Tony Blair has written a mischievous article for the New Statesman in which he implies that Ed Miliband is wrong about pretty much everything. Mr. Blair says that while the Tories have grasped that the politics of compassion is passé and that what voters really want is discipline, Labour is retreating into the touchy-feely all-you-need-is-love socialism of the past. I'm joined by Peter O'Bourne, the chief political commentator of the Daily Telegraph, and Dan Hodges, a journalist and former Labour adviser, to ask, is Tony Blair right and Ed Miliband wrong? Dan, is Ed wrong about welfare?
Yes, he's wrong about welfare. He's wrong about most of the big policy issues at the moment. I mean, I think you have to understand where Ed Miliband is coming from at the moment. I mean, we hear a lot about this one nation strategy. He's not actually pursuing a one nation strategy. He's pursuing what his advisors privately describe as the 35% strategy. He feels he can stagger over the line in the election in 2015 by clinging on to the sort of 29% Labour got in 2010 and bolting on an additional 5 or 6% from the Lib Dem refugees who have defected from Nick Clegg. And that is essentially governing his strategy. He's running a classic core vote strategy.
But it's working. Labour is ahead by double digits in the polls. So why is anything wrong about this strategy?
Well, Labour's 10 points ahead in the polls. I mean, if you look historically, actually, Labour's poll leads are actually quite low across most parliaments, and certainly in a parliament, mid-term in a parliament in which the government is introducing a programme of austerity, is teetering on the dip of a triple-dip recession, one would expect the opposition to be doing better than it is. And I think the reason it isn't is because Ed Miliband basically isn't trying to be any different. He's not taking any political risks. He's not reaching out to that, if you like, that group of Tory voters.
Well, he's opposing.
Voters.
Isn't he just doing what opposition's supposed to do and oppose whatever the government says?
Well, no, because what opposition's supposed to do is win elections. And the question is whether he's actually going to win the election in 2015. And I certainly... looking at the opinion polls, looking at the strategy, have my doubts. I mean, I know it's a minority opinion at the moment, but I think if Labour is only just managing to break a 10% poll lead at this point in the electoral cycle, if the economy starts to turn, once politics does start to be run through the leadership prism that it inevitably is as we approach election time.
Right. So a lot of it's going to come down to personality and the failings or the strengths of the individual leaders.
I actually think less the personality, actually. I just think Ed Miliband is not somebody who wants to lead his party. He's not somebody up to this point who has demonstrated a desire to take the difficult decisions that need to be taken.
Peter Oborne, do you agree with that reading of Ed Miliband?
I think Ed Miliband is much more interesting than that. I've been rather impressed as a whole by how he's performed as Labour leader. And I think on a series of issues, he's created the political weather, which is very difficult to do in opposition. But in general, I think that Miliband is much more interesting. And it's for this reason that I think he understands in a way which Cameron doesn't, and George Osborne certainly doesn't, that we are in a very dangerous and extraordinary moment in our national life, where the Blairite methodology and the economics and the Thatcherite economics all failed. The whole rule book for managing an economy and a society collapsed in 2008, and it's just as that happened in 1973 as well. In 1973, there was a 10-year period when we waited to find out what the next set of rules were, and Maggie Thatcher delivered something, a solution, which was nothing like what came before. She emerged out of the wreckage of the two-party system. And Miliband, I've read what he says, he gets that. He understands that we are in a system where the previous system broke down.
But he might get that, but I get no sense of what he wants to replace it with. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, you knew what the alternative was. So if he's just a leader who's saying this system doesn't work, I mean, that's not real.
You're talking very retrospectively about, very much with hindsight about Thatcher. I mean, I think you're right. By the way, I'll accept quite a bit of that, because I don't think that Miliband has thoroughly worked it out. But what I do think he can see is that you need to reconstruct a new set of rules about economic, social life in this country. And it's clear that Osborne, for the Tories, has failed, has given up that. The Conservative attempt to mend the economy has been abandoned. Right? Osborne has just accepted the Brownite insights, the Blair Brownite insight of high spend, and low, and be very, very lax monetary policy. That's all.
But I'm confused, because I thought the government's entire economic direction was about reducing the deficit.
Yes, I'm confused. I thought it was too, until I lost.
And that's what Blair says in his article.
Blair is very interesting. He is a completely busted figure. Blair. He ran a disastrous government which led us into a complete swamp, I'm fascinated by this notion that what he's supposed to say is interesting, because it clearly isn't.
Well, Dan, do you agree that is what Blair says interesting? Is it worth listening to?
Yes, I think it's worth listening to. I mean, I'm not whether it will influence Ed Miliband and influence the Labour Party. I think he's open to doubt. And the problem that Labour has and Ed Miliband has is that in that leadership election, he took the path to the left, and then to win a general election, the requirement is for him to pivot back to the right. But up until this point, he's been reluctant or unwilling or unable to successfully pivot in the way that he needs to.
I think you're fascinating when I read you on the Labour Party, but I think you're accepting that there is an attempt by the Blairites to create what they would call, because that's the way they think, a narrative which makes it impossible for Ed Miliband to succeed. What we're seeing here is fascinating. After Maggie was got rid of by the Tory Party, she just couldn't forgive it, and she took her revenge on all of her successors. It was a disreputable period of her career. Blair was got rid of by the Brownite wing of the Labour Party, and he's taking his revenge. It's the same sort of from the grave stuff that this article, very bad article, by the way. It's extremely poorly written. It's got no intellectual weight, but it has a very snide remark about Ed Miliband in it. And what's going on here is a deliberate attempt by Tony Blair to sabotage any attempt of an Ed Miliband led Labour Party returning to government. He has formed an alliance with David Cameron. It's very interesting. It's squalid politics.
Could I just pick up on that? Because I think one of the interesting things about Blair's article, though, is if you look at the way Blair has acted since Ed Miliband has won the leadership, in a way, Blair has been something of a bellwether for Ed Miliband's political fortunes. Whenever Ed Miliband has been doing well in the polls, and when Ed Miliband's leadership started to recover, you invariably see tucked away somewhere just a little briefing from one of Tony Blair's aides that Tony and Ed, that they speak regularly. They're on the phone, you know, every couple of weeks or so. Tony is there dispensing his wise words of wisdom. This was very different. This was an article in which Tony Blair is very much selling shares in Ed Miliband. And so I'm not so sure that Tony Blair is actually as engaged in the UK political scene now that he is trying to, if you like, shape his legacy and shape the forward momentum of the Labour Party and Labour movement. I think at the moment what he sees, which is something that I think you sort of subtly maybe detected over the last 3 or 4 weeks, is a sense that maybe the political weather is starting to shift against Labour and maybe back towards the Conservative Party. I think that's the real significance of the statement.
Also, he is a man who won 3 elections. He was very, very popular. He was by far the most successful leader the Labour Party's ever had. It's not unreasonable for a man like that to say, hey, things are going wrong, this is what you should be doing.
Yeah, I mean, there is that temptation which Maggie Thatcher also yielded to. I mean, Maggie Thatcher endorsed Blair at the end of her... I mean, after she'd become got rid of, really, partly, I think, as an act of revenge. And you're seeing here Blair moving not towards an endorsement of Cameron. It'd be too difficult for him, but to disendorse Miliband. It's very, you've got to bear in mind that Blair runs a global economic charitable empire. In order to make that work, he has to have very close access to 10 Downing Street. It just doesn't work otherwise. It's a sort of semi-official part of British foreign policy. It's a sort of privatized version of it, and he has to be close to whoever is in power, and I rather like Dan's point just now that, you know, he's sort of thinking that the wind is going back to Cameron. He'll buy a few more shares. It's more interesting to go back to the ideas which we were trying to discuss, and I think. To speak about Mr. Miliband, that he is engaged, and I don't want to cast a verdict on it yet. I just want to raise some questions. In an attempt, I've been reading his speeches and talking to his advisors and watching what he does to find a new kind of economic analysis for this incredibly dangerous period we are all living through. He's talked about. I don't find it totally convincing, but I think it's much more communitarian, to go back to an idea which Tony Blair himself played with in opposition. I think it has something in common with David Cameron's Big Society. It's not just one nation, which is a sort of fuzzy idea. It's an abolition. It's an attempt to recast social and economic relationships. He hasn't got there yet. I just think he understands it needs to be done.
Dan Hodges, Ed Miliband does understand, and he is thinking about these things very hard.
I think there's an element of truth in that. I mean, he is thinking about these things, but I think the problem is that after he's thought about these things, then his thoughts take him down a path in which he suddenly is faced with decisions. And when it comes to the decisions, that's when the problems arise.
In a sentence, Peter Oborne, can Ed Miliband win the next election?
Oh, yes, he definitely can.
Dan?
Yes, he can, but I don't think he will.
Dan Hodges and Peter Oborne, thank you very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us all on telegraph.co.uk.